Well, a conversation now on caring for the elderly. It was such a relief to read surgeon and Harvard professor Atul Gawande's latest book because it's about how we care for the elderly and the dying. And even Atul Gawande admits he had a lot to learn. He didn't know that hospices could actually prolong life or what to ask someone making end-of-life decisions. He wanted to know for his patients and his father, who begins to fail. So, as is Atul Gawande's way, he began studying what was wrong and found people who were doing it right. His book is Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And Atul Gawande joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And being mortal applies to everyone, including you, the doctor. And, once again, we read that most doctors don't take any courses in how to help someone die.
No, it's true. I didn't really learn about mortality in medical school. Our textbooks had nothing about aging or frailty or dying. The purpose was to teach how to save lives.
Yeah. Well, of course, there's a specialty, and we'll get to that in a second. But I want to leap forward because I want people to hear what's possible first. You write about a young doctor named Bill Thomas in New Berlin, upstate New York. He took a job
as a crazy doctor.
Well, as you say, and even crazier, is that Chase Memorial Nursing Home, when they hired him as a medical director, decided he could try his idea. What was his idea?
He walked into this place and felt that there was no life here. And he said, let's bring animals in. Let's bring plants in. And that's what he did. He wanted everybody to have a pet, everybody to have an animal that belonged to them.
He brought in 100 birds and established a daycare center for the employees' children. So there were children on site. How do you measure this success? You call this a success story. How is that measured?
He describes people actually just literally waking up. People who were catatonic before started to speak. They would get up and around and report on the condition of their birds. Then you got numbers like the amount of medications required for sedation and anxiety declined. There was even an increase in how long people survived. People found that there was worth to their days. There was purpose to being alive again, as simple as just being able to care for another being.
But I can just hear someone thinking, how can you just bring animals into a regulated place?
Yeah. It's very telling that we called these places nursing homes. We did not want to admit that these were places where we were trying to manage mortality. And therefore, we didn't try to think hard about what having a good life in such a place might be. We focused on health and safety. And that's why these places became like prisons. But there are places that remade themselves. One version called greenhouses really specifically make it so that the hallways, instead of having just these long hallways with 60 people on them in double occupancy rooms, made private smaller rooms with a dozen people ringed around, instead of a nursing station, around a kitchen. And one of the radical ideas was that anybody could get up and come from their room and go to the kitchen and open the refrigerator and get something that they wanted to eat or drink. That was radical because people would say, suppose they take a soda out and they're a diabetic, or suppose they're supposed to be on a pureed diet and they eat a cookie. You know what? These are choices people can make. And we live for more than just being safe or surviving. Even people with some severe dementia, they were showing they could be allowed to have choices and freedom. And that gave them a sense of more control over their life.
Talk about Peter Sanborn Place. It was built in 1983 as a subsidized apartment building for independent, low-income elderly. But then the manager there, Jackie Carson, sounds incredible. She just decided that I'm going to help my tenants as they age.
And as they got older, they got more and more needs. And the home health agency that would get called in would say, oh, these people belong in a nursing home. But Jackie would send them off and they'd be miserable there. So she said, you know what? We're just going to make it so we can keep them at home. And when the home health agency insisted that, well, they won't do it anymore, she started a home health agency of her own where she'd teach the nurses how to make it possible for people to make their own choices like we described, trying to address the fact that, you know, many of these people only have a year or two left in their lives. It can be full of purpose and something other than like bingo and group trips to a museum that none of them are actually excited about. That's the kind of transformation she was starting to make.
Increasing their quality of life. Even when one of the tenants had developed Alzheimer's, a private charity paid for the first overnight healthcare worker. So here's an apartment building with an overnight healthcare worker. I mean, it's thinking outside of the box. But now I can hear people saying, okay, that's one building that got a private charity to help them, but how do you afford it?
Well, so the fascinating thing is that it isn't about whether you've spent more or not. It's really about a cultural shift. It has to be goals that are bigger than just their health and their survival. Jackie Carson, making it possible for a woman with Alzheimer's disease to go out to a restaurant on Fridays with her friends. And you know what? She was diabetic, but she would want a margarita. And on Friday nights, they'd break the rules and she'd get a margarita. You know, like that is all the creativity took. It didn't take money. In fact, it often costs less because people's medication needs would go down. Bill Thomas, I described how the work he was doing when they brought the pets in actually lowered the likelihood that patients needed all the different kinds of medications they were on.
Well, it also takes the family signing on because you point out that a lot of the decisions that get made about the elderly, where they'll live and what they'll do, are made by adult children. They want to feel safer. And you may have to let go of some of that. You may have to allow your mother to go to an apartment building where the manager might let them go have a margarita.
Exactly. One of the most fascinating things that someone I spoke to said was, safety is what we want for those we love, but autonomy is what we want for ourselves. And we forget that about our parents, that they're going to have priorities that go beyond just being, quote unquote, safe.
It's Here and Now, and we're talking with famed surgeon Atul Gawande, his new book, Being Mortal. In it, he explores aging and dying. There's the history of nursing homes. They were started in the 1950s. In 1983, there was this new idea of a way station before nursing homes, assisted living, that started with forward-thinking innovators like Karen Brown Wilson in Portland, Oregon. But as Atul says, now anyone can call their facility assisted living. And in a study of the elderly by the University of Minnesota, half the people were assigned geriatric teams, half regular doctors. Those with geriatric teams lived longer. They had better lives at less cost. But right after that study, the entire division of geriatrics at the University of Minnesota closed for lack of funds. Atul, pick up there. You say only 3% of medical schools teach geriatrics. But geriatricians tell you, even if we realize how important they are, we couldn't train the number needed for years.
Yeah, who pines for their geriatrician? Right? If we took away the chance to put a pacemaker in the last couple months of your life, people would be hugely up in arms. But we've taken away in our country your ability to find a geriatrician, and there is not exactly rioting in the streets about this. But the people who turn out to have paved a path that allow them to have more freedom and more independence as they near the end of life have been people who often can get people who understand geriatric needs. And let me give you an example. I followed a geriatrician. He'd sit with a patient, be these long 45-minute interviews, and then he'd zero in and he'd say, well, okay, I saw a patient who had lung cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes. And he said, you know what the biggest risk for this person is? It's none of those. It's that they might fall. And there are known steps that can minimize the likelihood that they're going to fall. You have to know as a doctor how to examine the feet, recognize that a combination of medications can cause dizziness, and that nutrition can be huge. And this woman who is at tremendous risk of falling, a year later I saw her and she was still living independently at home without a single fall through that year. That is known information. We're not teaching it. And if there aren't going to be enough geriatricians around, that just means everybody who is taking care of the elderly, everybody has to be able to know what these skills are.
Well, so we've talked about the huge problem of the elderly who can't anymore live alone at home and alternatives to nursing homes that people are coming up with. But there's no getting around the ultimate destination. And you spend a good portion of your book talking about this. And it's really quite poignant because your dad is failing as you are learning the language to speak to him. For instance, you admit early on you didn't know what hospice care was. You thought it was to hasten death, but actually it extends survival.
Yeah. You know, there's this fascinating study at the Mass General Hospital. They randomized half of stage 4 lung cancer patients who only had on average about 11 months to live. Half of them got usual oncology care, and the other half got the usual oncology care plus saw a palliative care specialist who had discussions with them about their goals for when they get sicker. That group who had the conversations ended up choosing to stop their chemotherapy sooner. They had one-third fewer days and costs in the hospital. They started hospice care earlier. They had less suffering at the end of life. And here was the kicker. They lived 25% longer. And that just meant we're making bad decisions by not having the conversations to help people draw lines about when the sacrifices they're going through for the sake of possible time later are starting to exceed the value. A lot of the basic questions that they ask are pretty simple ones we can all ask. What are the trade-offs you're willing to make and not willing to make? What are the goals you have even if your health worsens?
So, for instance, if all they want to do is get to a wedding in a month, let them know a treatment that might not even do them any good might impair them and keep them from that wedding. So, Atul, this idea of asking patients what they want, this meant switching from someone you'd recognized you'd been, which is doctor information. You give the patient all the information about the disease and the surgery and the treatment, and you start switching, sometimes mid-session, to what do you want? What is a goal that you have? How eye-opening was this for you to be, after so many years, realizing, wait a minute, I have to ask them what they want?
It changed my practice pretty fundamentally. The switch to realizing we have to be effective counselors for people, which means asking them some questions that help us understand what they really care about, and then saying, yes, you have option A, B, and C, but I wouldn't do option A or B if what really matters to you is that you don't have your brain fuzzy or that you don't suffer a lot of pain. And, you know, maybe it's option C, which has fewer side effects, even though it might be potentially less powerful. Or someone else who says, I'm willing to go through anything for this sliver's chance of a total cure. Okay, then we're going to hit it and we're going to be on it. And we know this is going to be a tough, tough road, but you're willing to take that sacrifice. Different people make different choices, but it's being able to counsel them based on their priorities instead of just laying out the choices and then leaving people puzzled about what to do.
Well, and you know, even as we're speaking, and you acknowledge this, this sounds awfully close to rationing and death panels. How do you deal with that and the fact that, well, you were there? When it's your loved one, you really get tempted to try anything.
A death panel that says you can't have what you care about in your life is what people fear. The panel of doctors and nurses who say, if I understand that this is your priority in life, and therefore this is what your best path is, we will provide that path for you. That's like a living panel. and that when my father went through what was a brain cancer and it was not curable, we had these series of conversations. There was a colleague's father who said that what mattered to him is that if I can eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on television, that's good enough for me.
In other words, he might have been paralyzed by an operation, but that was okay as long as he could watch TV.
Yeah. And my dad said, that is not good enough for me. He was a social creature and he wanted to be able to still Skype and see people. Also, he wanted to still make contributions that made a difference in the world. And as long as that wasn't taken away, that's what he was willing to live for. And so that's what we worked to maximize. And it guided when he decided to go for a very aggressive radical operation that did buy him more time without quadriplegia. When he started to become quadriplegic, it guided our decision that he would go for radiation therapy. When that didn't work and it made him worse, it guided decisions that he would not do chemotherapy and go on to hospice, end up for 4 months on hospice, and right through that time, continuing to work on the charity projects he had, having dinner parties and seeing people, having family over. It was a pretty amazing.
Do you think you got it right for your dad?
I think after 10 years of being a surgeon where I felt we were not getting it right for my patients, I felt like for once we were with my father, we were getting it right.
Well, that's surgeon and Harvard professor and author Atul Gawande talking about his own experience with his dad passing. The work that he did to understand the end of life is compiled in his latest book, Being Mortal. It's just terrific. Atul, we are so sorry for the loss of your dad, but what a great tribute to him this book is. He was also a doctor. So thank you for talking to us about it.
Thank you.